The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on April 9, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. First thing I guess I'd like to do is just welcome you all to Sesshin. It's been a while since we've had one here at Dharma Field, and so it's really, really I'm grateful that you are all here today. It's a, you know, it's a strange practice, Sesshin is, we support one another in our practice just by being here, so thank you for supporting the practice, for making Sesshin possible here, and welcome. I know we have some people who are doing this for the first time, so welcome to you as well. So today I'm going to give a talk that's based on a koan from a collection of koans called the Iron Flute. And the particular koan I'll be looking at is Case 1 from the Iron Flute that's titled Manjushri Enters the Gate. So before I talk about this, I just want to really quickly talk about koans. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but I want to at least spend a little bit of time on it because koans are unique teachings and are teachings that are unique to Zen. There are several traditions of studying koans in Zen, and just to let you know, the one that I think people are maybe aware of before they take up Zen is the idea of sitting with a koan, studying it and sitting with it perhaps for years, and then sort of having some kind of breakthrough or understanding with the koan. That's not the type of, that's not the way that we study koans in Soto Zen. So that's Rinzai Zen. And it just came to my mind because I talked to somebody recently who is maybe interested in studying at Dharma Field, but he thought that that was going to involve koan study. So we do look at koans in Soto Zen. And in fact, one of the great koan collections, the Blue Cliff Record, is a Soto text. But we look at these teachings less as something to sit and meditate with, but instead they're pointers. They're very unique teachings. You know, if you've read koans, you know that. They can be maddening sometimes when you first encounter them. I know a lot of people just don't like them. They don't like them because they tend to be elusive. That's A-L-L-U-S-I-V-E. So they might allude to other teachings, and they might do it just by dropping an image in. So suddenly you have somebody picking up a whisk, and that whisk actually has a history to it. So they're alluding to some other teaching by picking that whisk up, and the koan's not going to explain that to you at all. You just see the teacher pick up the whisk, and all of that teaching comes along with the picking up of that whisk. So it can be elusive, and because of that, people find them elusive, E-L-U-S-I-V-E. You know, they sit there and they go, what is going on with these things? And so koans have this tendency to have a flavor to them like they're puzzles. And Steve Hagen told I thought it was kind of an amusing story about his teacher, Dainen Katagiri, had asked Steve what he made of this koan, and Steve said something like, well, it's kind of a puzzle to me. And then Katagiri wrinkled his face up. Steve said like he just sucked a lemon and said, koans are not puzzles! But they seem that way because there's something about the way that they point. They don't do a lot of elaboration. It's a lot of just getting us to start to realize how it is that we approach reality, which is to think there's an answer. We do that all the time. We go, there's got to be some way that I can understand this. And when we say that, we mean to intellectually understand it. And so with koans, with these seeming puzzles, then we approach them as if they have a right answer to them. So I just want to point out there is no right answer to koans. There's no right way. This one's going to sound crazy maybe, but it's true. There's no right way to practice. It might not make sense, but where your practice is, as long as you're practicing, that's your practice. So Steve Hagen wrote a nice introduction to this Iron Flute, and unfortunately this particular book is out of print, and it's been out of print for quite a while. But Steve wrote a nice introduction to it, and he talked about the fact that Koans not only have no right answer, but they have no conceptual answers. Again, they're trying to get us to see that that's how we want to engage with the world. So he writes, with every koan, the point is not to arrive at an answer through our ordinary conceptualizing minds. Rather, the point is to see for ourselves that our concepts can never provide us with a satisfying answer. And that is something that we will struggle with. People will hear this teaching and think they're being told not to conceptualize, which is not at all the case. But the reason you hear that is that people just can't, I'll use the word conceive, because I think that's what's going on. They just can't conceive that that the conceptualizing mind isn't how we figure things out, isn't how we get to the heart of the matter, so to speak. But the koans are going to help us to see that when we try to rely on that conceptualizing mind, it's not going to win. It's always going to get befuddled. So koans are also not paradoxes. They have that reputation. I talk about them as being puzzles, that they state some kind of paradox. I'm going to talk about the title of this collection in a moment, and it's going to sound like a paradox to us. But these are not paradoxes. Again, in Steve's introduction, he writes, koans themselves are not paradoxes at all. Rather, they direct our attention to our own sense of contradiction or paradox that naturally arises in any conception of the world. Koans help us to see that these apparent contradictions occur only within our minds, not within the world itself. And I think this is a very profound statement, right? We go through the world, and the world seems to us like it's filled with paradoxes. Paradox and confusion. It just seems like that's the way the world shows up. And Steve's saying, the world doesn't show up that way. But the reason that paradoxes arise, the reason there seem to be intellectual boundaries or mystery to us, is because our conceptualizing mind can't possibly deal with reality. At some point, it's going to fall short. So, again, there's no right answer to them. They don't pose paradoxes to us. Koan itself, koan means public case, ko public on case. And Steve points out, it's a public case because these point to reality. You can't get any more public than that. So when you look at our precepts, you know, one of the teachings by Buddhadharma, one of the legendary but great ancestors of Chan, of Zen, he points out at the beginning of every one of his teachings on the precept, self-nature is clear and obvious. Reality is public. It's just right here. Nothing hidden. Nobody owns it. It's not private. Can't be. It's not the nature of reality. Steve tells us koans are a practical way of watching our own minds, paying careful attention to what is really going on, and perceiving reality directly, free of our ideas about it, explanations for it, and habitual responses to it. So koans can help us to see, you know, what's going on with our minds. And again, they do that because of that nature I was talking about before, where we go, what paradox, what confusion, you know, there's something showing up in them that doesn't seem to make sense. And we can watch our minds trying to come up with an answer. Koans will often actually start with a question. You know, see how often we want to just come up with the answer. And then when the student might come up with an answer and then get hit with a stick, we might go, well, what answer would I come up with? How would I not get hit with the stick? And that is something we can notice. That's what we desire, not to get hit with the stick. And to fill in the blanks, to give an answer that's not going to have us get hit by the stick. So that's just sort of an overview of koans. I wanted to tell you that because these koans aren't aggressively, you know, strange or seemingly paradoxical, but they're so brief. You know, they're so directly pointing that they almost feel like you're missing something. You get to the end and you just go, wait a minute, that, you know, you're waiting for that next sentence. So keep that in mind as I go through these. So a brief background. I don't know too much about the compilation of the Iron Flute. but it is a relatively recent koan collection. It's from 1783. It's not as well known as some of the other koan collections that are in existence. Probably most famously the one I mentioned before, the Blue Cliff Record. Blue Cliff Record is an amazing document. So even if you don't like koans, even if they really make you scrunch your face up like you just bit into a lemon, it's worthy of looking at the Blue Cliff Record, just looking at one of the cases. And the cases are the little teachings they have. Because the Blue Cliff Record is an amazing, you know, work of, let's say, spiritual literature. So what you do is you'll open up the case, and there'll be this thing called a pointer, and it seems like a very puzzling poem that in and of itself, I would say sometimes the pointers feel more puzzling than the koans themselves. So you read a pointer, and then you get the koan, and then you get some commentary. And I think Blue Cliff Record is this way, a number of koan collections are. And then you get people commenting on the commentary, like later commentators. So you have a sort of a layering of commentary. And then there are poems at the end. I mean, it's a really wonderful thing. And none of it is easy going. But it's going to show us how it is that when we encounter this stuff, we're going to try to understand it. So this one is not as well known. The Iron Flute is not as well known. But it does collect 100 koans, which the Blue Cliff Record does as well. This isn't as layered with commentary. This doesn't have the pointers. This only has some commentary, not all the koans do. This particular translation does have commentary by Nyogen Senzaki. And Nyogen Senzaki was a Zen master from the 20th century. And I probably know him best as the guy who was involved with translating the stories in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. So that's him. I have a whole book of previously unpublished teachings by him called Eloquent Silence. I really love the title of that, and I will be probably drawing on it for my silence class that's coming up. So this again was compiled in 1783 by a Zen master named Genro. The Japanese title for this is Tateki Tosui. Tateki Tosui. Tateki means iron flute. So there's our iron flute. Now, what is an iron flute? I mean, it may not be an image that strikes us as particularly anything at all. But just think about Japan, especially in the 18th century, but, you know, the traditional Japanese flute is bamboo. It's not iron. So there's already something going on there with this particular flute. Right? So Japanese flutes are bamboo, and they have mouthpieces, and they have little holes in them so that you can produce different tones. And some of that sounds familiar with flutes we're familiar with in Western music. But this iron flute doesn't have a mouthpiece. This iron flute has no holes in it to play. And yet, it sounds. It sounds music. So that iron flute, talking about that paradox, we're going to go, wait a minute. It's just like an iron bar. And it somehow sounds music. And I would say that that image is pointing us back to the nature of reality. This seemingly impossible object that plays music even though we can't manipulate the way that we think we can. And then the other word, tosui, means to blow upside down. So not only do we have an iron flute that has no holes on it, no finger holes on it, nothing to make sound, but then it's playing it upside down on top of it. And it really is getting at that notion of how it is that reality is just here, resounding, making that music, just right now. Doesn't need us to play it. Right? This is an impossible object. Here it is. It's making music, but there's nothing about it that seems like it should be able to make music. And again, that's just because of the way we conventionally understand what's a flute. You know, how do we play it? And it doesn't work that way. So that's sort of the background for this koan collection. And now let's get to the koan. So this is Manjushri enters the gate. One day, Manjushri stood outside the gate when Buddha called to him. Manjushri, Manjushri, why do you not enter? I do not see a thing outside the gate. Why should I enter? Manjushri answered. That's it. That's our koan. So just one more time. It's pretty short. One day Manjushri stood outside the gate when Buddha called to him, "Manjushri, Manjushri, why do you not enter?" "I do not see a thing outside the gate. Why should I enter?" Manjushri answered. I'm going to talk about what I see this koan is pointing to. And again, since there's no right answer to koans, when you pick them up over the course of your life, you'll just see different things in them, different aspects by which it's pointing to reality. So I'll get to what I'm seeing in it when I read that. And some of it actually was with the assistance of Senzaki's commentary, where I saw something and went, oh, I see, that's a little more higher up on the hierarchy than I would have put it, perhaps. But before I talk about the koan, we'll talk about the characters in the koan. And just know that oftentimes koans are stories between a master and his disciple. And in this case, we have Buddha and we have Manjushri. And Manjushri is one of Buddha's great disciples. So I probably don't have to tell you who Buddha is. He's one of the characters. Often these characters, you know, when I was reading this, when I encountered it, I thought, I don't know too many koans, actually, that have feature Buddha. Most of the koans I know are about Chan masters. So this is kind of an unusual koan in that way. But Manjushri is one of, as I said, one of Buddha's disciples. His name literally means he who is noble and gentle. He who is noble and gentle. And he's a bodhisattva of wisdom. Now, I will say when I read that, I thought every bodhisattva pretty much is the bodhisattva of wisdom. It seems like whenever I read about one of the bodhisattvas, that's what they say. But they seem to have different aspects, too, of wisdom that they seem to symbolize. So Manjushri is the symbol of, the experience of enlightenment is manifested in intellectual exposition. So this is in teachings. It may seem counter. We go, weren't we just talking about the fact that conceptual knowledge doesn't at all have to, or can't in any way really point us to reality? Well, I didn't say point us to reality. I said it can't really address reality in a satisfying fashion. And this is where you want to watch it, because now we're conceptualizing what it means not to conceptualize. And we think that intellectual exposition in and of itself, you don't do that. But we do that. We're human. We're going to engage in intellectual pursuits. It's just, what do you do with it? How do you take this up? Are you thinking that in taking up intellectual understanding of something that you got it, that you're going to get whatever it is that you think you're looking for simply by looking at intellectual understanding? Now, if what you're looking for is how does a faucet work, well, maybe reading a book on that would help. But that's a different kind of knowledge. When we're talking about the kinds of teachings you find in the sutras or that we find in talks like this, the teaching is about something else. And then words do ultimately fail, but they can help us. We do hear, even though I'd say this is a little bit less perhaps intellectual exposition, but we have teachings, as we do with the sixth patriarch of Zen, of Chan, who heard a passage from the Lotus Sutra recited. Or was it the Diamond Sutra? Was it the Diamond Sutra? Right, he heard a passage from the Diamond Sutra and suddenly had some understanding. So we'll hear that. So Manjushri is a symbol for the experience of enlightenment as manifested in intellectual exposition. And so his name was often at the beginning of philosophical Buddhist texts as Manjugosha. So it wasn't Manjushri, which shows Manjugosha, which means the gentle-voiced one. And so at the beginning, there'd be a little homage to Manjugosha, and that's to Manjushri. And in fact, it was not uncommon at the beginning of Majjhimaka texts. And Majjhimaka is one of the early major Mahayana schools, very influential on Zen. If you've heard of Nagarjuna and the Mula Majjhimaka Karika, which if you're at Dharma Field, you're going to hear about that at some point or another, that's in the Majjhimaka school. That was a teaching that was, I'm just trying to think how to encapsulate it. It was a teaching about emptiness, really, and about how it helped Buddha's followers see that they were misunderstanding emptiness. You know, it's a very profound teaching. one that in and of itself was frequently misunderstood. So now I'll get back to this. So that's Manjushri then, the Bodhisattva wisdom, disciple of Buddha. And it seems to me that at the heart of this koan, at least this time as I'm reading it, it seems to be about the question of practice, about Buddhist practice. So if we just think about what it is that is going on in this koan, it opens with Buddha, right? And he's standing, Manjushri's outside the gate, and Buddha's calling him to enter, right? He's inviting Manjushri in. And I think we can see this as, I don't want to say a symbol of, but of what's even going on today. Buddha is inviting us in. Buddha is inviting us inside the gate. And what do I mean by that? Am I talking about the historical Buddha? Well, sure. Why not? In some ways, yes. The Buddha who presented these teachings. These teachings invite us to investigate our experience. These teachings invite us to look at what it is that's taking place in our life. So in one way, yeah, we got the historical Buddha and he's inviting us in with his teachings. Inviting us into what? Well, that's a good question. We'll talk about the different ways that we can understand that. But we can also think of Buddha as being Buddha nature. That's another way that the term Buddha is used. So the nature of reality. And the nature of reality is inviting us in. There you go, inside the gate. So again, Buddha says, why do you not enter? Why do you not enter? So you think about reality, same thing. Why do you not enter? Well, where are we exactly? Well, we're at that place where we feel we're outside the gate. Right? We think we don't. Something's missing, perhaps. I don't want to say a secret necessarily, but there's some understanding to what's going on here that we don't have. And we encounter that. We don't even have to ever have encountered the Buddhist teachings to have that feeling. That's just life. Life starts unfolding, and it just seems like you're on the outside of it. And, you know, I think on one hand, when I say something like that, I go, hey, maybe that's when you're older, you know, and life starts dealing you a bunch of disappointments that you start to notice. But I don't think that's true at all. I think when I was a little kid, and parents would have these rules about how you did things. I did not get them. They did not make any sense at all. I felt totally on the outside. Like there was some kind of understanding that my parents had that to me almost didn't make any sense. And I was on the outside of that. So I think that we feel that way actually right at a pretty young age, that we're outside. Reality is inviting us in. It's just showing you, you're outside. Come on in. Why are you out there? And of course, there are all kinds of reasons that we might find ourselves out there. But are we out there? Where are we? You know, it gets back to that thing I was talking about, the koans and the sense of paradox. The koans aren't paradoxical. What is paradoxical? What's the way we put the world together? Reality isn't paradoxical. But our understanding is. So when we're a child, we start to see that stuff. We just see the fact that it doesn't make any sense. It's not, you know, it just seems to be arbitrary and random. Or a because I said so kind of thing. And then we get Manjushri's response, and that response to me is pretty rich. It's got a lot that it's saying. And that's what I'll spend most of my time talking about, is his response. So remember, Buddha invites him in. And Manjushri says, I do not see a thing outside the gate. Why should I enter? And this is one of the things that made me think about practice. Because if we think about the scene that's going on here, we just think at sort of the most immediate way of understanding the scene. We have this gate where Buddha's followers are studying and practicing the way. That's what they're doing. So it's inside the gate. And Manjushri's outside. He hasn't entered yet. So Buddha's saying, why aren't you entered? Why haven't you entered? Why haven't you gone to sit with the others and sit in meditation or sit and study? And what you see in the Buddhist question. And a lot of times teachers will do this. They're kind of like sounding out, what is the student's understanding? So why aren't you in there practicing with everyone? We could reframe the Buddhist question in one way. I think the Buddhist question is meant to kind of see a bit where Manjushri's understanding is. But we can see him saying, why aren't you in there practicing? And you get Manjushri who says that he doesn't see a differentiation between practice and life. So he doesn't understand anything is outside the gate. Is that the way he puts it? He says, I do not see a thing outside the gate. So that separation between practice and life, Manjushri sees that the two are not separate. Outside the gate, outside the meditation hall, we'll say, it's practice just like it is inside. It's life inside the meditation hall just as it, how could it be otherwise? And I say that because it's very easy to make these kinds of distinctions. To think of, say, when you come to a meditation hall, just to look at our practice, as somehow being distinct from our life. Maybe more pure. And I do put that in quotation marks. Because I know over the years that I've had my own contentious relationship with religion. It has seemed like religion is living in la-la land. And then there's the world out there. And I think that same thing happens with practice too. Well, it's fine and dandy to sit in meditation when you're in a place like this. What else can you do? You know, it's not like we have a lot of flashy stuff you can get lost in. You're just going to be sitting here working with your mind, watching what your mind does, watching what maybe your body does and then what your mind does in relation to your body. So that's what you're going to be doing here. But it seems like, hey, you know, I can sit in meditation. I can actually quiet my mind. And I would be very wary of all of what I just said. But there are narratives that I've heard people say. And I can do that well in a meditation hall. But get me out in the real world. And I can't. I just can't do it. You know, it's too much craziness out there. I don't like my boss. I don't like my coworkers. My spouse and I are having troubles. People drive like lunatics, whatever it is that we have. There are all kinds of things that just kind of catch us up. There's a war going on. There's a pandemic raging, right? So all of that stuff. How am I supposed to do this? I can do this in a meditation. So we're separating this practice from life. We're making it like the meditation hall is something different. Something, I hesitate the word sacred just because I don't know that I ever really thought of it that way. But I think I kind of did. I didn't understand how it was understood here. So my first sesshin, I slept in here. It was kind of an unusual space to sleep, but they told me, you can sleep wherever you want to in the building. And everybody was sleeping downstairs. And I could just tell by that way that floor was that was really not going to feel good for me. And I didn't think about putting a cushion down, of course. But, you know, I was just like, it's cement. I'm going to sleep upstairs. And then they told me you can use the cushions up there. So I was going to sleep up here. And somebody left that candle lit. And they left. So I'm in a meditation hall, and it's 9 o'clock. It's actually probably going on 10 o'clock at night. And I'm aware of the fact that candle's lit. And I'm going, it just doesn't seem like a good idea to leave the candle lit. You know, I should probably put that out. And then I thought, what if it's some sacred thing and this flame has never gone out and they go from candle to candle and this flame has been going on for 30, 40 years. So I was sitting there going, do I put this out? Is this some kind of sacred thing? Because it seems to me like a fire hazard and I want to sleep. You know, I don't want to sit there worrying about whether that candle's going to somehow make something catch fire. So it was this real agitated thing that was going on. And finally, I just decided safety first. I was like, they're just going to have to yell at me if I just extinguished a 30-year-old flame. So I put it out and I went to sleep and then found out I did the right thing. And I say all that because, again, we think about, you know, could this be a sacred space? Well, I didn't know. I don't know. When people bow at stuff and do things in this room, I don't really know exactly. When I started, I didn't know what that meant for sure. Because we make those distinctions, right? We're actually just, I would say, when we bow, when we greet, when we take our time, we're just doing what we can do, actually, in our daily life which is just when you're served your breakfast. You know, be there with your breakfast. How many of us actually, in a way, greet, we don't have to say, hi, breakfast, but how many of us actually take the time and notice our breakfast as it's being served? So we can do that, and we can do that in a way that's not weird. So I say something like that, and then the next thing we do is we, in the world out there, we start flipping practice in real life. So rather than just accepting our breakfast and moving on, we might really look at our breakfast. Take that spoon, really taste the oatmeal, you know, take a slice of orange and take 5 minutes to chew a slice of orange. I mean, you can do all that, that's fine, but that's not what the practice is actually. It's just telling us, in your daily life, when you're taking up your things, just notice, just pay attention. And in doing that, you're respecting and honoring. And you could say you're seeing what's sacred in life, which is just this, all this stuff. You ever think about how wonderful it is, even the stuff you hate? Just what a miracle it is in a way that it's showing up. So, you know, we make those distinctions, but we don't have to make those distinctions. When we make those distinctions, then problems arise. So I think about, somebody was just telling me about when she used to sit meditation here, kind of early in her practice. And she would, to get to the meditation hall on time for the sitting from where she lived, she'd tell me, I had a speed. I had to go like way over the speed limit to get here. And I would speed, you know, from where I lived all the way to the meditation hall. And then, you know, the whole time, you know, just constantly the adrenaline flowing through, hoping she can get through the other traffic, and then park and then run into the meditation hall and then sit. And at some point, guess what? She realized, I don't think that's what this practice is about. Right? But when you make that separation, when there's life and you're out there and you got to come to the, yeah, you separate those things. And you start doing things as seemingly innocent as getting to the meditation hall on time. Meanwhile, she's driving recklessly and she's getting herself all worked up and she's going to bring all of that right in here with her. So that's going to be what she practices with. Nothing wrong with that, but there's no need to do that, you know. That's up to you how you come into the hall. But the way that this space is actually designed, you probably notice it when you come in. When you come in, as you start taking off your coat, you're already starting to be mindful. Most people. You don't just, you know, quietly take your coat off, quietly take your shoes off, you place them in a, there are those nice shoe racks and everything out there, so you place things, you know, just kick your shoes up and tear your coat off. You don't do that. You know, you actually start taking care of what's going on. Think about that. That's her meditation practice, is what's showing up. Take care of it. There you are in the shoe room. So you can do that. You can actually take up the meditation practice. You might even notice that as you are getting ready for the meditation practice at home, that you're starting to collect yourself. And then you come in, and then you have these forms that are, do nothing more than ask you to pay attention to how do you step into the room. There's your cushion. What is that cushion? And we greet it. And the whole universe is showing up as cushion. We're greeting the whole universe when we come in. So we don't have to break up the world that way. You know, when I first started practicing meditation, I listened to a CD. So I was, before I came to a Zen center, it was Daniel Goleman, you know that guy? He wrote the book Emotional Intelligence, kind of a... He's one of the many people that I would talk to. Todd's aunt, who lived in San Francisco in the 1960s. She moved there in 67. And she knows all these guys. Ram Dass, she calls him Richie. And Daniel Goleman, she calls him Danny. Oh, Danny, yeah, he's a great guy, you know. And I was like, hey, you know all these people. Anyhow, so I had Daniel Goleman's meditation CD. And the first thing he says is, close your eyes. Now, you won't be able to do this meditation practice while you're driving. And I remember I thought that was pretty funny. And then I thought, you know, after I did it for a while, I was like, but I want a meditation practice I can do while I'm driving. And our practice, we keep our eyes open. That was really weird the first time I had to do that, because I was so used to closing the world out. But again, our practice isn't to close the world out. We don't have a safe little space that we climb inside when things are going bad, to feel good. That's not what our meditation practice is, and that can be what it can be misunderstood to do. So we look at then the Buddha's question, you know, well, if you think about what I'm talking about here, making that distinction between practice and life, which is one that seems to come naturally to us. Sometimes when we hear there is no distinction between meditation and life, people think, oh, well, then I don't have to meditate. What's the point of that? And that's one that I hear. If, say, doing the dishes or doing the laundry or driving my car or eating dinner, if that's all meditation practice, which it can be if you take it up that way, but if that's all meditation practice, then why do I bother coming to the hall? I can just do all that stuff in my daily life. You can kind of see in that there's still a separation between sitting meditation and the rest of your life. You don't ask yourself, well, you know, washing the dishes and making the bed, they're both domestic chores, so why do I have to do both of them? You know, I'll just do one of them, right? Or if we look at the meditation practice, I don't have to meditate while I'm washing dishes because I'm going to meditate while I'm doing the bed or whatever the case might be. We don't make those distinctions, or we don't have to make those kinds of distinctions. So our meditation practice isn't just another thing that we go, well, let me put it this way. In life, we just don't do that. We don't say, I take care of something when I do this so I don't have to do this other thing. Right? Meditation practice is just meditation practice, and it has what it is that it offers, which we see when we come here. It's a real opportunity. And you see this in Sesshin. Sesshin is an opportunity to get to see your mind very subtly. Very subtly. It's just what you're doing out there. Now you get to see it. Out there, I'm making that distinction that we want to make, out there, it gets blocked as we get caught up in objects. So when we're here, which is the same as out there, we're just watching what our mind is doing. But when we're here, we just have this. So we actually start to see what takes place when we're out there. Really no distinction. The only distinction is in our mind. Out there, we get caught up in stuff. Out there, there are things that are driving us crazy. In here, there can be. I don't want to make this feel like it's a space where that doesn't happen. Maybe somebody next to you, I don't know, they're fidgeting, or maybe their tummy's growling, or they're just doing something that's irritating you. Maybe it's somebody sitting next to you, and you just had an argument, you know, I don't know. And you could also just encounter yourself while you sit here. One of my early sesshins, I used to ask people, how'd the sesshin go? Innocent enough question, but it's really pretty meaningless. Because first of all, you're going to understand that from moment to moment, it's going differently. From sesshin to sesshin, at the beginning especially, it might be like, my first sesshin was like, if we had a, like, this is normal, you know, what we might think of blasé going through life, then my sesshin experience was like way down here. And then the next one was way up here. And I remember talking to my teacher, Steve Hagen, about that. And he just said, yeah, it'll even out after a while because you're just kind of grabbing onto things. But I remember asking a guy afterwards, you know, how was this sesshin? And he just looked at me and his eyes were like abysses almost. And he goes, I am so sick of myself. So, you know, we can encounter these same kinds of things in here that we do out there. That's, again, we don't want to really make that distinction. But the meditation hall is just a situation that's set up that really provides an opportunity for us to see the ways that we get caught up, the ways, again, that koans can help us to see that we get caught up. So we have then this one element of Manjushri's response that's about, well, I don't see a distinction between practice and the real world. So why do I need to enter the meditation space? And I would say that there's another dimension to Manjushri's response that ties into this question about practicing that has to do with the nature of reality and experience. that I think is worth touching on at least. So Buddha's question, why do you not enter? You can see that as sort of, why are you not waking up to the nature of reality? Why are you not waking up to your experience? Why do you not enter? Why do you hang out outside the gate there? And why are we not awake? So thinking again about this as an invitation to us all and not just to Manjushri, why are we not awake? And a related question to this is, where are we when we're not awake? Where are we? What are we talking about? What are we talking about when we're talking about awake? What is awake? Now, these may sound like pretend questions. But if you're taking up the practice and you're saying, you might hear something about enlightenment or waking up or having a sort of like insight. What is that? That is one thing we'll ask ourselves. What is that? We want to make a thing out of it, so we'll expect an answer. It's this. Then you'll hear teachers say something like, well, you're all awake. You're all Buddha. And then you say, well, if I'm Buddha, then why do I not feel like I'm Buddha? Right? Why do I feel outside? So we're getting back to that idea of being outside the gate. We feel that we're outside the gate. People will say that. Like, well, I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it. I'm not quite there. I'm not, and wherever it is that they establish this. I brought this up in a class recently, but there was a student who used to come here, and she was out in the coat room, and she said something like, you know, I really don't know what these teachers are talking about, but I have a feeling that if I find out, I'll be disappointed. You know, so she's put herself outside the gate, and she's really kind of sealed that gate nice and good, you know. It's just going to be misery. In a way, that's really helpful. And you can see if you've kind of made life that way, you've made life that way. You can see that. That's a pretty tough place to be. You'll be running against that one quite often. But yeah, so where are we? And I would even say that question is a good question. Where are we? When I was talking to Todd's aunt about, I don't know, Ram Dass came up, and so they were all, oh, Richie, yeah, you know. One question Todd's uncle said, one question Ram Dass asked when you're sitting meditation, he'll say, Jonas, where are you? This is when you're meditating. And I went, wow, what a great question. And it is actually a really great question. Where are we? Where are we right now is the question. So where are we when we're not awake? Where are we when we're outside the gate? What does outside the gate mean? And I think that's one thing Manjushri's pointing to. He says, I always have to look exactly what he says, but he says, I do not see a thing outside the gate. So what is it that, where are we? What is outside the gate? Now we have a pretty well-known image in at least Zen. I don't know if it's out, you know, if it's a teaching that's outside Zen or not, but I know it in relation to a collection of koans again, but it's the image of the gateless barrier. Right, that there's the barrier between what? Well, whatever it is we feel we're outside of, satisfaction, happiness, not suffering, right, there's a barrier, they say like a giant wall surrounding that. And there are people in there. You know, we could think of enlightenment, awakeness, and there are people inside of there. And I want to get through that barrier. And there are people who are inside that barrier, so to speak, that we can't find the gate to get in. It's a gateless barrier. And we spend a lot of our life being concerned about being inside that barrier, looking for that gate. So what we spend a lot of our time and energy doing is looking for the gate. And it becomes, that's the thing we do. We forgot that the point of it was we maybe noticed there was something off and we're trying to wake up to where reality is. Because we're so damn busy looking for the gate. So we end up like really making our whole life about finding that gate. And you're not going to find it. It's a gateless barrier. And sometimes that gateless barrier is translated as a gateless gate. And somebody recently kind of poo-pooed that translation because it's probably not too literal. Thomas Cleary translated it as a gateless barrier. And I think he was trying to be very faithful to the original. But again, gateless gate is not an uncommon way to translate that, because it gets at something very important about that gate. What is that gate? Well, we'll hopefully get there as I talk a little bit more about this koan. So one of the things about that gateless barrier then, that student I talked about in the shoe room was experienced, is that when we're confused, it seems like there's no way to enlightenment. It just sounds like some abstract term, perhaps, or some fantasy or some ivory tower. Again, world outside here doesn't allow for that. But Manjushri tells us we're already inside the gate, right? So he says, I don't see anything outside the gate. We're already there. We're already awake. And that one really confuses people. It gets back to that whole question, well, I'm awake? Hardly. You know, if I'm awake, we're doomed. Or if I'm awake, well, then what's the point of doing this practice? And I think of that great teaching of Shunryu Suzuki. And he says, you know, when I look out and I see you all, I see Buddhas. And then you open your mouth to speak. You know, because there's something going on there. There's something about being awake and being confused, that there is a difference, even ultimately when there isn't a difference. Right? The distinction between being confused and being awake is profound. Though the distinction ultimately, it's, you can't find it, right? But when we're confused, we see everything is outside the gate. And this is tied into a way of understanding the world that actually affects how we act in the world, how we understand, you know, our place in the world, how we understand other people's places in the world. And this is the kind of stuff that I think, again, can kind of sound philosophical, you know, and not particularly useful in daily life. But this is the idea of the fact that we see the reason that we feel like we're outside the gate, the reason we've even created this idea of like an outside, is that's how we see all of reality. In other words, it seems to us that reality is there's this stuff that's outside. And we could call it outside the gate, but we know it's outside. And what is it outside of? Well, it's outside of us. You know, it's this world that's outside of us. And it's baffling and it's maddening. And maybe there's something out there that we want. And this is common. This is what I was talking about with that gate. So what we do when we see a world like that, when we see the world, not our world like that, when we see the world like that, when we see reality like that. Again, I told you, Buddha's always inviting us in. We see it's all, it seems to be outside. Buddha's always inviting us in. Reality is always inviting us in, telling us that the way that we're seeing the world isn't quite right. But we don't understand how far-reaching this confusion is. So we don't understand that when we look out and we see a world that's outside of us, that's actually what Manjushri and Buddha are also talking about. Because they seem to be very unrelated. Everything I've just been talking about might seem unrelated to the fact that I see a tree out there. And there are people out there. There are things out there in the world and that I interact with them. Because that's the way the world seems to be. So I'm not going to deny that it appears to be that way. But we do start to encounter this sense that that's not the full picture. We might not think of it that way. We might not say, oh, the fact that there's a tree out there is not the full picture. But we actually feel very dissatisfied with the whole way we package the world. And you might have one of those moments where it all just doesn't, the whole thing just doesn't seem real. You might have those. I know I did way before I ever took up Buddhism. Just a weird moment and taking a shower and you just go, the world can't be the way that I'm putting it. It just can't be. I just had this flash of insight, and I think we all have that at a very fundamental level. That's not, it sounds sort of like stoner college talk, you know, but it's not. It's actually something very profound is going on there. So I thought it might be helpful to bring in another koan. I won't spend as much time talking about it, but just another koan that's more famous than the koan I'm talking about that addresses some of what I've just been starting to touch on here. This is a koan from the Blue Cliff Record. So again, that's a very well-known koan collection. And this koan is case 46, and it's Jing Ching's Sound of Raindrops. And I bet people are familiar with this one. Jing Ching asked a monk, so Jing Ching is our Zen master, "What is the sound outside the gate?" The monk said, "The sound of raindrops." Ching said, "Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things." The monk said, "What about you, teacher?" Ching said, "I almost don't lose myself." The monk said, "What is the meaning of I almost don't lose myself?" Ching said, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. And again, I think this case really gets at what the case in the Iron Flute is pointing at as well. So we have the master asking, what is that sound outside the gate? So we have another thing outside the gate. And this, again, we could just picture a very immediate sort of first impression image of what's going on here as the teacher's talking about something that's happening outside the gate. It's hard to say. It could just be, posed by the teacher to see what the student's understanding of reality is, you know. So we get the sound of raindrops. What's outside the gate? The sound of raindrops. So if it is raining, well, it's not such a bad thing, depending on how the student understands that, because that is what's showing up. So when we hear that, say, the world that's outside isn't really the way that we put it together, and people start thinking, those things that are showing up aren't real, because, well, here they don't have substance to them. They're not really what it is they appear to be. We might think that we're being asked to not, I don't want to say eradicate them, but to kind of treat that world as not existing. So then if it's raining out, you know, you'll have a student will say something like, what's the nature of reality? And the student will say, or the teacher, I'm sorry, a student will ask a teacher, what's the nature of reality? And the teacher might say, 3 pounds of flax or the oak tree in the front yard. It's a similar, could be a similar kind of answer, depending on the student's understanding. And that's pretty paramount. So Ching then just sort of says that, you know, okay, there's the sound of raindrops, but we get caught up in that. So he says sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things. So, okay, it could be the sound of raindrops, but then again, it might not be, depending on what it is you're talking about. Suzuki also pointed out, Shunryu Suzuki, jumping outside of this koan for a second, in another teaching, said, you know, this one I can never quite remember how he said it, but it was something on the order of, you know, I hear a bird out in that tree, but when you say that you hear a bird out of that singing out of that tree, we don't mean the same thing. You know, we're not talking about the same thing. And again, that's what I think the master is talking to the student about. What is the sound of raindrops? We can easily get caught up in the raindrops, easily get caught up in the bird and see it as something that it's not. That again is that sense of being outside the gate, getting caught up in our conceptualizations of how reality appears to us, getting caught up in the appearances and taking those appearances to have a reality that they don't have. They have a reality, they have a truth, but they're not what we think. We think the way that we put the world together is the way the world is. And all you have to do is, ask a termite in the floor here if the reality that that termite is experiencing is the same reality of this room that we are. Now, I look at spiders sometimes. They're so little in the way they... Well, some of them are little. Some of them are scary and big. But the little spiders, you know, the way they move around, how fast they can move through a room. And then I think to myself, what does the room look like to that spider? And it's kind of... I have no idea. But I wonder, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, where everybody gets small, and then the world, that our familiar world, suddenly everything's big and scary. Or The Incredible Shrinking Man, you know, where the cat now is a giant monster, terrifying the guy. So we can see that just in a real simple mind exercise, that the way that things appear aren't that way for everybody or everything. So it's already telling us that it's just not, the way we put it together isn't absolutely true. But we tend to do that. And once we tend to do that, as Ching says, they lose themselves. These are sentient beings. This is most of us, right? We are inverted. We lose themselves and follow after things. So we lose ourselves, just as I was talking about before. We actually feel like something is missing. And it's ourself. When Ching is talking about that, though, that I that he's talking about, they lose themselves. He's talking about an I. I lose myself, and so I follow after things. That I that he's talking about, this is your true nature. This is the I that's not the I that we normally think. You know, we might tell ourselves, well, I'm Steve. And we know that that doesn't really mean anything. We know that if somebody says, who are you? And you have to describe who you are. If you've been at like a dinner party or something like that, and you've never met somebody before, and suddenly you're trying to figure out, how do you present yourself? The person's asking you. Maybe they'll ask you what your job is, and maybe you don't want them to know what your job is. I used to have those jobs where I was embarrassed. I remember bumping into somebody from college, probably about 8 years after undergraduate school, and I was so embarrassed by what I was doing with my life that I could hardly even look at her. You know, I didn't want to tell her I was a file clerk for a mortgage company. You know, that's what I was doing. Because I somehow thought that was something I should identify with. That was my identity, was that. You know, and then I would have had to explain why I was that while I was trying to do something in the theater or whatever it was. It's just complicated. And then I realized that's not even who I am. There's way more to that. So anyhow, it created kind of a difficult situation. That's what we think I is. That's not what Ching is talking about. He's talking about if we let that junk go, then what's here? What's this? That's the I that we lose, is this. Because we're following after things. As we start to make stuff up into things, and then we don't have enough of something, and we might have too much of something else, and so we get lost. Now, in the Blue Cliff record, I didn't write any of this stuff down, they have little, like, it's almost like a scorecard of the Zen masters, and they put little, like, footnotes on almost every line. And they're talking like, oh, the master really, really dropped the ball on that one. And then, so when a student says, what about you, teacher? They're like, yeah, that monk's onto this guy. You know, he's trying to get the teacher to reveal that he can't really say it or whatever. And so then Ching says, I almost don't lose myself. And one of the footnotes says, oh, he lost the matter at this point, you know. But that doesn't matter. I was just sort of amused by that because the student's questions can sound very naive, like, oh, what about you? And what is the meaning of this? Whereas the Zen master's commenting on this realized that the student's actually in the game. You know, he's actually like, he knows what the teacher's saying. Oh, interesting. It's like that. Okay, well, how do you do it then? You know, just to see, does this teacher finally step into making something, making some kind of construction that then you can take apart? Like the Majjhimaka school I talked about before, what they do is you take a statement where you talk about the way reality is, and they just find the loose thread that's always there, and they just pull on it until they reveal that the statement you just said has no logical coherence to it at all, even though it seemed to. So we have the student asking, what about you, teacher? He says, I almost don't lose myself. Now, that's interesting. I almost don't lose myself. He said, sentient beings lose themselves. Well, it sounds like he's losing himself then, but he almost doesn't lose himself. Now, he's talking about a different I at this moment. So that I he's talking about is that ego self. I almost don't lose that ego self. Here we are. This world's constantly challenging us. We'll see from moment to moment, the I shows back up again. Because again, we just immediately will construct this world into being outside the gate, and that gate is inside us. the way that we imagine it, rather than thinking of the way they're talking about outside the gate, which is just not really penetrating into the heart of reality. So when the teacher says, I almost don't lose myself, and he's talking about that ego self. And then the monk keeps pressing his, well, what is the meaning of this, I almost don't lose myself? So he's like got, in a way, Ching kind of, if you're playing chess, you know, he's got him on the retreat a little bit. And then Ching says, though it still should be easy to express oneself, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. This is kind of a curious line, but I think it again gets back to the koan from the Iron Flute. So when Ching says that, he says, though it still should be easy to express oneself. Let me just look at that. Of course it's easy to express oneself. And he's talking now about one's true nature. That self that we lose because we're chasing after things. And the real question is, do we lose it? Like, how can you possibly lose it? As I've been saying about reality before, you know, its nature is not that there are things out there. So losing something implies there's some thing that you can lose, and that usually you lose it someplace, or you lose it behind something, drop it in the couch or whatever it is that you do with it, right? But this, what he's trying to tell us is that true nature really is never lost. No matter how confused you might be, you're still expressing true nature. You know, so you can't escape that. Reality is always showing up. You can't help but do that. I don't know if that makes sense, but you're just showing up as confused. That's all. You don't really lose your self-nature. So Ching says it should be easy to express oneself, because anything you do is an expression of that true nature. Anything you say is an expression of that true nature. Really, anything you do or say or think reveals your understanding of true nature. And it might be completely wrong. And a lot of times we do get it wrong. And you can tell by the way people talk, and by the way your Buddhas, until you open up your mouth to speak, right? You can tell where people are coming from. So it should be easy to speak, but he says to say the whole thing. To speak, to act from reality, from totality, from something that's not broken up into things, he said, that has to be difficult. That's actually impossible to say it. But to actually realize, that's what he's talking about, to say the whole thing has to be difficult. To actually say this requires effort. This is the nature of practice. So yeah, nothing is really outside the gate. But we don't realize that. Most of the time it feels like there's this gate that's keeping us from what it is that we want. And we feel like we're outside of the gate. So we have to make an effort to say the whole thing, because that's difficult. It's very difficult. So much easier to get caught up in our things, in the scenery that shows up in our life. And that can be, you know, even abstract things, you know, things we read about in the newspaper, you know, but it also is the little stuff that we sweat at home too. So we can easily get caught up in that. So we have to not get lost, to not lose ourselves chasing after those things. And that thing might even be trying to find that self-nature. To not do that takes effort. That's what this practice is. And that gets us back to Manjushri's, I do not see a thing outside this gate. Why should I enter? Now, it's interesting to me that we have this particular story, because it ends with, why should I enter? And it makes it sound like Manjushri's saying, well, I don't need to practice. And again, this is a conundrum that does arise when you hear you are already awake, you're already Buddha. Well, why practice? Well, I think I've already made a case for that about how easily we get caught up in things. But if you notice, Manjushri actually does enter the gate. That's the title of the koan. Manjushri enters the gate. So the question is more of a question rather than a statement of purpose. Well, I'm not going to practice. That's why do this? Why enter the gate. Do you see? Rather than refusing to practice, it's just a question. I do not see a thing outside the gate. Why should I enter it? Now, what is that gate anyhow? I invite you to think about that. I've been tossing it out there, and I told you a translation of the gateless barrier is the gateless gate. Because the gate still implies there's something to enter and exit, and there's some place that you do it with. Yet, if you take up this practice, and if you don't lose yourself and follow after things, the barrier is not there any longer. And that's what I think that gateless gate is helping us to see, is it's not really a gate the way we think of it. Is there's this thing that we do, we open it up, and then we step through. The gateless gate is the gate that isn't really a gate. It's to realize there's no barrier. It's to realize there's no gate to do this. Confusion and awareness, as I was saying before, being awake and being confused. Ultimately, no distinction, and yet we can say there is a distinction. We can tell when people are acting from confusion. We can hear the pain and the suffering that comes from acting and thinking and seeing from that place. So we take up this practice to realize the nature of reality. We take up this practice to say the whole thing. As Master Ching says in the Blue Cliff Record. Manjushri enters the gate. And we do this. Or we get lost. And where? I don't know. Where are you? And where are you, Bruce? Where are you, Daya? It's a great question. What are we talking about? And this practice, again, is about not losing that self. The answer to where are you, much less caught up in the way we might normally think that question is being, and instead being a sound of a gong, you know, ringing. You hear those bells, bong. Where are you? Bong. You know, how do you answer that without answering it, but with really realizing the import of that question? So that is my talk for today. I don't know if you have questions or comments. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.